What's up, everyone, and welcome to the sixth episode of Shooting the Breeze. I'm your host, Max Hooper, and the purpose of this podcast is for me to share my unique basketball experiences and perspectives while also sharing those of my guests. For those of you who aren't aware, my entire senior season at Oakland University, I did not attempt one two-point field goal, and I took a whole lot of threes, 257 of them, as a matter of fact. I've always prided myself in being a great shooter, and that is what continues to propel my basketball career. So, yep, you guessed it. On this show, we'll be talking shooting. Today, I have a very special guest, Tom Coverdale. For many college basketball fans, this is a throwback name. Tom played basketball at Indiana University from 1999 to 2003. Up to this point, all of my guests have been current college players or current professional players, so I wanted to get a little bit different perspective by having Tom on the show. Tom played professionally for a handful of years, and then he was an assistant college basketball coach for 6 years after that. Today, Tom and I will talk about his experience of playing at the University of Indiana, his thoughts on shooting, his transition from playing into coaching, among a handful of other things. Without any further ado, what's up, Tom? Great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Max.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, Tom, I didn't speak to you about this before we started recording, but this is going to sound crazy, but I've actually seen you play in person.
Really? Where was that at?
I don't remember it specifically. I remember being there, but I don't remember specifically. My dad and I took a trip to the 2002 Final Four in Atlanta. And, you know, it was Kansas, Maryland, Oklahoma, and Indiana, I think. But
Yeah, so that's right.
I would have seen you play. And I vividly remember, you know, obviously the pinstripe warm-ups and Jared Jeffries, et cetera, et cetera. But just thought I'd have to share that with you and share that with the listeners. But so the way I want to get this started, you know, the basketball historian, you know, might know your story. And I did some research, dug in, and figured it out. But let's just talk about, you know, your journey in basketball and where – maybe starting with, you know, high school and how that led you to playing at Indiana and on into professionally. So go in as much detail as you want. Let's just talk about your, you know, your individual basketball journey.
Okay. Yeah. I grew up in the state of Indiana. So, obviously, grew up a huge Indiana basketball fan and Bob Knight fan. So, all through high school, I went to Noblesville High School, which is on the north side of Indianapolis. And, you know, had a good high school career and was fortunate enough to win Mr. Basketball in 1998. So then from there, I got recruited by Bob Knight and went to Indiana University from 1999 to 2003. So my freshman year was Coach Knight's last year at Indiana. So was kind of there through all of that and the transition when he got let go. And then my last 3 years, didn't play much as a freshman under Coach Knight. We had a lot of senior guards with, you know, A.J. Guyton, who was an All-American, and Michael Lewis and people like that. but then as a sophomore, you know, was fortunate enough to start my sophomore year on the last 3 years under Mike Davis. And, you know, had a great career, wouldn't change, you know, anything about it. You know, loved the university. And like you said before, we're fortunate enough my junior year to make it to the national championship game when we got beat by Maryland in the final. So, you know, after that, went to the Portland Trailblazers Summer League team. You know, did that and then played in the CBA at Rockford, Illinois for a year and then went to Germany for a year. So played a couple years and then realized, you know, I knew I wasn't going to make the NBA. So I kind of wanted to get into coaching at a young age. So I did that for 6 years and then moved back home. And now now I'm in the insurance world. So had a great and long career from playing and coaching just throughout my career and have learned a lot, definitely.
Sure, yeah, and that's why, you know, that's why I want to do this podcast is share. Everyone's journey is so unique and everyone has such different things to share, you know. I can't say I've had anyone on my podcast who played at Indiana or played professionally in Germany yet. So, you know, just want to get the totally, you know, different perspectives, and we'll dig more in depth into your college career later on. But you know, I titled my podcast Shooting the Breeze. And I'm, you know, people who listen to the podcast, you know my reputation as a 3-point shooter. So let's just start talking about shooting, you know, right away. Let's say you're teaching a young player and you're just starting from scratch. What are three keys in your mind to shooting the ball when you would teach someone, or maybe that you look at a shooter? What are three major keys that might pop out to you?
Well, number one, especially for young kids, is just hand placement. A lot of kids, when they're really young, they want to, shoot from far out and shoot threes because that's what they see on TV. But at a young age, they can't get it up there. It's almost like a throw. So just getting their elbow in and that. And then once you get older, I think what separates a good shooter from a great shooter is definitely their footwork. And what I learned in college, and then was able to teach when I was a coach, is having the same foot placement no matter whether it's a set shot off the dribble or off the pass. And a great analogy I use is when you line up to shoot a free throw, if you're right-handed, you have your right foot slightly in front of your left, or if you're left-handed, vice versa. And there's a reason that you set up that way every time for a free throw, because it's right under your shoulders, and you can ex when your right foot's a little bit in front of your left, you can extend that arm a little further. And so what we really worked on is, there's a lot of kids out there that can just catch and shoot, but can they really come off a screen and catch and look down and get their feet exactly like it would be lined up as a free throw? And if you watch all the great shooters, even today, if you're a young kid in junior high or high school, I would definitely look at all the shots that guys make during games and just pause it right before they shoot and look how their feet are aligned. And it's the same position, whether it's off the catch, off the bounce, or off the, just a set shot. And I think that's the most important thing for a young kid to learn, because if I knew if my feet were the same way every time, no matter where I was on the floor, in my mind it felt like the same shot. And then the last thing I would say is just, doing this, your hand and your form and everything, doing the same. Everybody has a different release point and stuff like that, but doing the same thing every single time. Not varying your form from your waist up is very important. So, and then obviously the last thing is just repetition. If you just as well as anybody, if you don't get shots up on a regular basis, then you're not going to have the confidence to make shots in a game.
Right, I like all that because you might be a little more articulate than some of the younger guests who haven't I most of the guys I've had are still currently playing at whatever level they're at, and that's something that I've always wanted to be a coach, but I feel like I've always been a high IQ player, but sometimes people kids will ask me, how do you shoot so well or whatever, and I don't know if I can articulate it in a way that I know what works for me, but I don't know if that would necessarily work for you. But the footwork, the consistency, and then you don't get that consistency without repetition. I don't think I've ever met a shooter, a true knockdown shooter who isn't obsessive about it and a gym rat and just crazy about getting shots up and perfecting their
Oh
form.
yeah, I mean, you have to make a game out of it after practice. I'm sure you had certain games where, we used to, I would shoot 25 threes from one spot, and we'd do like 15 different spots of threes on the floor after practice, and you just see how many you can hit out of 25 from each spot. And, in college, you're fortunate enough to have managers that can feed you, so you can get a ton of shots up. But there's so many devices these days that as a young kid in junior high or high school, whether it's the gun or different, you can still have coaches and family that can feed you a lot of passes. And once you get the right form and the right footwork, and like I said before, the footwork more, the reason you want to do that is just you have to have good balance to have the same shot every time. And so, like you said, it's the footwork for balance. It's doing the same thing with your hands and getting the elbow in, and then just getting a lot of repetition in.
Totally, and I think once you get to college and you're, let's say let's fast forward a little bit from being a young kid, you've established yourself, you're a college, you're a threat on the college floor, the other team, their coaches are screaming at their players, run them off the line, run them off the line, don't let him get a shot. So that's where the footwork comes in. You know, anyone can just stand there and bury shots, but are you going to be able to, you know, bury shots on the move with a hand in your face? And I mean, that's something, you know, I had to adapt to, because as I established my reputation in college, you know, people, I was a marked man, you know, the scouting report.
Yeah.
Run him off the line at all times. I'm sure the other coaches were saying, I don't care if he blows by you, you have to run him off the line. And that's what, like you said, the footwork being the same every time and doing it at a, you know, a high pace, because typically the shooter has one of the better athletes on the other team guarding him and trying to take that threat away, because the three ball is just so valuable. It's a backbreaker when a guy buries a three at a clutch time in the game. So let's extend on the shooting discussion a little bit more. So let's talk about, I think the three keys you talked about were great, but then also I think there's another aspect that you go into, is the shooter's mentality, the mental side of shooting. What are some thoughts you might have on that?
And I used to always, when I was in coaching and as a player, you know, every shooter been through a slump, or either where you're feeling it and hitting every shot you put up. And that just shows how mental shooting is. So, you know, I always tell people, picture yourself, you know, act like before you shoot this next shot, act like you've hit four in a row. And if you think that way mentally right before you shoot it, normally they'll step up and just start hitting it. And that's why you hear all the time people talk about, well, he could miss four in a row and he's going to continue to shoot. Well, yeah, because you have to have that mentality. You have to feel like every shot's going in. And that's why when it's so hard for people mentally to get out of a slump, if they've gone 1 for 10 or 1 for 15, you know, mentally it's hard for kids to, you know, immediately think, you know, pretend like I've hit four in a row even though I haven't. And, you know, that's why there's streaky shooters and there's consistent shooters. The consistent shooters, you know, like yourself, you can block out a miss. And that's very important that you have to do that. And then the other thing to get through mental stuff is knowing that you've put the time in, like we talked about before. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've put up, you know, 1,000 shots in a week or 2 or 3 days going into a game, you mentally know you've done everything you can do to prepare. And so when you catch it and you got an open look, in your mind, you should be surprised if it doesn't go in.
Right. I like all that, because, you know, a shooter without confidence is one of the worst things on the basketball court, you know.
Yes.
Actually, a shooter without confidence is usually not on the floor, because, you know, if you're turning down shots and, you know, being selective, then you know, a shooter's not gonna, you're not gonna be in rhythm when you're shooting. Cause a shooter has to have no conscience to be the fullest of you know, to live up to the fullest of their abilities. A shooter has to be shooting with no conscience. You know, doesn't matter if there's a hand in the face, whether you missed 10 in a row, whether you made 10 in a row, you know. And I think a lot of kids or up and, you know, developing players, they might think they know what that means, or they might, you know, think they understand what that means. But I think that's something that just comes with experience and time, because I knew I had to develop that, because when you miss four in a row and you're playing against your rival on the road and you got the opposing fans screaming at you, telling you you suck and you've just thrown up an air ball or something, that fifth one, you know, theoretically that fifth one, you know, sounds nice. But when you step up to take that shot, that fifth one isn't quite as nice, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely a different feeling, and that's what's so hard for – that's why you have so many streaky shooters. And I think there's a big difference in, for people to understand, you know, if you've missed four, it doesn't mean to keep shooting and shoot bad shots. You know, these should all still be good shots, you know. But we're talking from a mindset of when you're open and you know it's a good shot, that mentally think this one's going in regardless.
Right.
And it just comes down to, like you said, confidence. You know, that's a great point. I've never met a good shooter that's not confident in his shot. Mm-hmm. And it goes to putting in the time and then also having the confidence to think every shot's going in.
Right. Right. And I think also a lot of that has to do with your, you know, your coach and your situation and your teammates. Do your teammates believe in you? Does your coach believe in you? Does your coach afford you that type of you know, leash to be able to miss a few shots and still stay in the game? And, you know, I feel like from my own experience, when I went to St. John's prior to Oakland, you know, if I missed one or two shots, I think I was pretty much done for the game. You know, that was the extent of the confidence my coach had in me.
But yeah. Then
when I arrived at Oakland and I had my preseason meeting with Coach Greg Campy, he told me, you have to shoot the ball with confidence every time. I don't care if you go 0 for 15 from 3. If you shoot it with confidence and you truly believe it's going in, you can go 0 for 15 from 3, and I will not care. So
yeah, and exactly. And I think to add on to that, too, I think, you know, sometimes there are definitely coaches that don't let you have as much leeway as others. But as a player and thinking of it from a coaching standpoint, too, that's things as a player you can control. On how your player and your coach looks at you, because we had kids that I coached that thought they should shoot it every time, but never got any extra shots up.
Right.
And you know, it's just like, well, you're not going to sit there and miss 4 shots in a row, and your players look at you the same way. You know, you know, it's just like preparing for a test or anything else in life. If you're always in the gym getting extra shots up, your teammates are going to look at you like, well, you know. At least we know he's doing everything he can do, and we're going to continue to feed him because we know he can make it.
Totally, totally. So we've talked about, you know, the shooting a little bit. Let's talk about what type of impact a shooter can have on a team as a whole, in your opinion. I think in college I was a complete specialist, but, you know, you were a shooter as well as being like a point guard, a facilitator, those sorts of things. So you kind of have two different perspectives, I think, on this, but just what type of impact does a shooter have on, you know, other players with other skill sets on the court and just the team overall?
Well, I think it's a huge impact. Not only can it shoot the ball, but from a, like you said earlier, a defensive standpoint, they have to lock in on you. Mm-hmm. And to have a shooter like that, like, you know, say we're going, going against a team that you're on, your defender can basically not play help side defense. Mm-hmm. And so it opens up driving lanes for people that can get to the basket because that they have one less guy that can help. And also it helps the post guys because if you're on the same side as the post guy or even opposite, there's no way they can leave and help off on the post guy. You know, like you said, in college, we had a guy named Jared Jeffries who was an All-American, had a long NBA career, and that's basically – what we did is we had me and two other guys that could really shoot the ball on the perimeter. And so the only thing we did, we knew no one could stop him one-on-one. Mm-hmm. So we'd throw it into him at the beginning of every game just to see, you know, how they were going to play him. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't double him, we just kept going to him, and it's one-on-one all day. And then eventually when they had to double him, we knew we were going to get open shots. So, you know, having as many shooters as possible can change a game just because their defense and their coaching staff has to make a decision on what they want to beat them.
Right. And that's what you see in the NBA these days. You know, you really see a superstar or two and a bunch of shooters spaced around them.
Yeah.
And it's just because when a star player has space, they're that much more effective. You know, they're that much more in isolation situations. Or then even if you get, you know, your star scorer in screening actions with the shooter, then you got guys miscommunicating, talking about, are we switching, are we staying? And then it's just, you know, I just enjoy that as a shooter. I love being tagged and chased around. Just, all right, run with me. You want to run with me? We can run all day. And I won't even have to touch the ball, but I'll get my guys open shots. So
yeah, exactly. It just frees up. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it from a standpoint of if you're playing 4-on-4 basketball instead of 5, there's a lot more space to drive and, you know, work in the post. Well, you know, 5-on-5 can get clogged up, especially if you have a couple guys on the floor that can't shoot the ball because they're just going to sag off and, you know, they can pass it to you wherever and you can just get back to them and cut off the drive. So it puts a lot more pressure on the defense.
Totally, totally. And I actually, one of my college teammates that I had on here, you know, he was like a guard for us. And so he liked, you know, delivering the ball to me all the time. But he suggested that when a shooter, you know, say a shooter runs off a pin down and both of the defenders go and the big man's wide open for the slip, he says, I think the shooter should get the assist for that. I like that.
Kidding.
You know what I mean? I like that.
Yeah. There's so many. Yeah, like we said, it's just puts pressure on the defense in so many different ways. And you see it, you know, in every game you watch.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So something else I wanted to touch on, you know, I feel like a shooter's role is so well defined, because that's, you know, something you can quantify and, you know, put it into pretty direct terms. But what about, how important do you think it is for a team to have well-defined roles, you know, for guys to know what their job is and to help others do their job better? And just how important is it for the players to define those roles, and also for the coach to help in defining those roles?
It's probably one of the most important things in a team, because so many times you see average teams that have so many talented players that are trying to do something they can't do. Mm-hmm. And that's where your role comes in, and that's what preseason and all that, you know, the team that went to the Final Four, you know, we had guys on our team that knew exactly what their role was, and a role can be different. It's just basically what are you best at and what's best for the team. And right. I think in today's game, it's hard for kids to take a back seat when they're not as good at something as they should be to help the team win. You know, if you're a 30% shooter from 3-point, you shouldn't be taking 10 threes in a game.
Right.
You know what I mean? But if you're, you know, up around 40% or a little under, you know, then obviously you're a lot better shooter and it helps the team, and the percentages are higher and better for your team. And, you know, it just comes down to, like you said, different roles. And, you know, I think that's where some coaches are just separate themselves and are better, because they can get kids to understand their roles better, and, you know, makes the team a lot more successful.
Right. And sometimes there's definitely challenges with those roles too, because on a team, you know, there's only going to be one or two featured guys offensively. You know what I mean? Everyone else is going to have to fit in. And if you're you know, let's just talk from a coaching perspective. If you're coaching at a high level team, you know, in like you played in the Big Ten, I played in the Big East, you know, high level college basketball. You're recruiting guys who were the man in high school, and
yeah.
They're not used to being told, well, your role is rebound and play defense, or your role is set screens, or your role is just get the ball to the scorer in his spot. So, you know, I think that's something, like you said, the great coaches are able to create, you know, collective buy-in from everyone and believing in that a certain player doing their role to the best of their abilities is going to be best for the team. But as you said, in this day and age, you know, everyone is instant gratification. You know, everyone wants to be pros right away. And it's just sometimes you run into talented teams that underachieve because they
that's definitely a great point. And I think part of it too is the culture of a team and program that you're going into. Mm-hmm. If you're going into a program that has a great culture, and a great example right now in today's world that people maybe can relate to is in the Big East, Butler. Mm-hmm. You know, that I use them as an example because I watch them all the time because I'm from Indianapolis.
Right, local, and
you take a kid like Keelan Martin, who was their leading scorer and wasn't doing some of the things, or was taking some bad shots and not doing things he was supposed to do. And he's been coming off the bench as a leading scorer for the last month. Mm-hmm. And the kid's attitude and everything he's done, you can give him nothing but credit. Now he's playing just as well as anyone on the team, still coming off the bench and getting 15 a game. And that goes to the coaches getting the whole team to understand from a culture that they've built over time that, you know, no matter who you are, you know, you're replaceable as a starter and, you know, different elements if you're not going to do everything that we're asking of you. And, you know, that you got to give the Butler coaching staff credit for being able to prove a point like that. And now, you know, obviously they're playing their best basketball they played all year, beating Villanova twice and just on a roll. And I think it's because of that culture. And like you said, everybody knowing their role and doing only the things they can do.
Right. And I think that, you know, that's super important. I hadn't heard of that kid, but definitely an effective scorer coming off the bench. If you got a guy who's averaging 16 coming off the bench, then I think you're in good.
And he started all last year and this year. So it's just a mindset of, you know, you got to do everything that's within what you can do to be able to play here. Cool. So,
and I think something that I don't know if, you know, this is something that I experienced in college was, as our roles took time to develop. You know, you can't just have the coach, okay, you're the shooter, you're the point guard, you're the scorer, you do this. I think those are something things that kind of develop organically, you know, in practice. And like you said, preseason, you're practicing and scrimmaging and playing open gym in the summer. Those roles just form over time. And I don't think it's when you got a bunch of new guys on a team or lack experience with the great leadership, then I think those are things that come in time. But something that I took pride in was, you know, I knew I was going to shoot the ball, but then I wanted to use what I do to make my, you know, the guys who score inside, I wanted to make them the best they could be. And then I wanted to make my point guard the best he could be. So I wanted to move without the ball and create openings for him. So I think when you get roles that mesh together like that is when you really got something special, rather than, you know, five guys who just want to come down and ISO every time and, you know, dribble the air out of the ball. Then
yeah, exactly. And that's what when you see a good team that, or teams that are winning their conferences, it comes down to knowing their roles and being good teammates and everybody gelling well together. And it definitely does take time. You know, that's why it's playing, you know, teams that have had guys together for 2 or 3 years, you know, obviously are going to play well together just because they've been doing that. And you know, it's just like, you know, you take Kentucky, for example, who has a different team every year. Some teams and some years it's taken them longer to develop and gel together, you know, even as talented as they are, you know, just because from the fact it takes time to be able to know where everyone else is at, going to be out on the floor and playing with different guys for longer periods of time.
Totally. That's a great example. So we've touched on it a little bit, but just, I mean, you've been out of college basketball for a while, you know, now, but you're not that old. You know what I mean? You're only like, I don't know, 12 years older than me. So you're not that,
yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to say like you're an old timer, but how much has college basketball changed in that relatively short period of time? I mean, I feel like it's so different these days.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's different from a player's mindset, like you think, especially when kids these days have so much access to, you know, social media and all that kind of stuff. I think they don't take criticism as well, if that makes sense. So, like you said, you don't see a lot of teams coming together or some kids, because if you tell them they're not good at something, it's harder for coaches to get them to believe what they're saying is true, because they've been told their whole life. But, you know, for the most part, I think the game is the same and a lot of the stuff, but, you know, and also I think the way they call the game's a lot different. We could get away with a lot more defensively, and it was a lot more physical, where, you know, when the game started getting more low scoring, you know, five or so years ago, because of all the physicality, or 10 years ago, you know, they've really taken away hand checking and stuff like that, which has really opened up for people to drive, and games are more high scoring.
Totally.
For sure.
Totally. And like what you talked about, the whole social media, and like, frankly, even just for me, you know, not necessarily college, but because I've only been out of school 1 year, but the whole recruiting, you know, because I've been away from, you know, the high school recruiting for now 5-6 years or whatever. This, you know, guys are blasting on, you know, Twitter and Instagram, just got my fifth offer, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah,
it's almost odd to me, just like, it's almost bragging, or it's like, if you don't get the, it's almost about like satisfying yourself through social media rather than, you know, finding the best school that fits you. And it's strange to me. And also what you touched on, you mentioned it a little bit, I want to talk about, is how you said kids can't take criticism. It's funny because, you know, back before social media and all these sorts of things, you know, the fans would have their criticisms or whatever of the players, and it would just fall on deaf ears because they just go home to their living room and say, oh, this player was horrible, you know, he's terrible, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Now, guys open up their Twitter account, and they've got thousands of notifications, you know, after the game. If you're playing at a big school, you're on ESPN every night, et cetera, you know, and you have a rough game, you know, you might not want to look at your account for a couple of days because it might be a little rough. But I just
think, yeah, you know, and definitely, and that's part of it, you know, just the fact that, you know, and even when the part you talked about with, you know, someone saying I got my fifth offer, or saying something that comes across as bragging when you're being recruited, well, you're still a high school kid and you're young. Well, when I was coming up, if we said something stupid like that, it was just to our brother or someone at home. It wasn't out there for the world to see and for the world to criticize, you know? So in a way, I kind of feel sorry for the kids growing up today with all the social media and, like you said, the immediate contact. If you have a bad game, unfortunately, there are people out there that would write to somebody and say something that they would never in a million years say to their face.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's disappointing, but that's the world we live in today.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I think something that also gets lost in the social media, you know, your experience was different because, you know, you were homegrown, you know, IU fan all your life. And once IU got, I read something, you know, do you think this is accurate? Once the IU call came, pretty much your recruiting process was over. You know, that's where you wanted to go for sure.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Right. So then I think something that's a little different, but then what kids run into these days is, and I actually dealt with myself, is when, you know, when you're being recruited early, you know, it's probably because a school sees you as either someone who's a little bit better than their level, if you're a mid-major, or they just view you as a perfect fit. And then, you know, if you're a good high school player, keep getting better, then later on in the process, all these schools are going to come popping up. You know, the high majors who missed on their first, second, and third guys and are looking for, they need a guard or they need a certain position. And you don't want to be in a situation where you're the fourth or fifth option. You know, that's just not a, that won't be a, you, I don't think you'll be happy in that situation just because you're not in their plans. And so I think guys kind of get lost in the name when a big name school comes calling. And
yeah, there's definitely kids that get recruited to hire, you know, either, like you said, where they're their fourth or fifth option. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then they get recruited over the next year. Just say the next mm-hmm. year they get their number one guy on their list.
Exactly.
Well, they automatically believe over that guy over you coming in. So, you know, it is. But, you know, I think the recruiting process is, it was like that back in my day, too. It's just, you know, the only advice I can give kids is just, you know, it's kind of like when you get on a campus and, you know, it just feels right and that's where you're supposed to be. Just wait for that feeling and follow that, even if it's a smaller school than what you're being offered later.
Right. And obviously, you know, the big schools have tremendous opportunities to offer, and like playing in, I can't even imagine what it's like playing in, you know, Assembly Hall against, say, Michigan State or whatever for a Big Ten game. You know, the atmosphere is just incredible. But, you know, I was attracted to that sort of atmosphere, but at Madison Square Garden, St. John's, you know, I wanted to go play under the bright lights and play in that arena and play against the Big East teams. But, you know, Madison Square Garden doesn't look so good from the bench, I'll tell you that.
But, yeah, it's definitely different.
But, you know, part of me, you know, I have no regrets, and I don't, you know, but I wish I would have been able to, you know, play and be at Oakland for 4 years and do what I did for the past 2 years for you know, my whole career. But, and now more than ever, you know, you see, especially guys who have, you know, aspirations to play in the NBA, you don't need to go to the huge school. Steph Curry, you know what I mean? Damian Lillard.
Yeah.
And then even, I've dealt with it with my teammate Kay Felder, you know, he's 5'9" from Oakland University, and you just never know. So I think,
No matter what school you go to, if you continue to get better and you're, you know, the NBA does not care what school you're from. Exactly. If you can play and help them win and can compete at that level, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, especially when I got into those camps and stuff, there was, you know, kids from Florida and then other smaller schools, and they don't care about what school you came from. It's what you're doing in that camp or against other competition. And so, you know, that definitely doesn't matter when it gets to that level.
And there's, like I said, there's just different, you know, different things that about the, you know, high major schools that attract kids, whether it's the, you know, the fan experience, you know, the game experience or the facilities or the, you know, the, just the college experience overall. You know, it's just everyone has different things they value, but I just think the problem is kids who, you know, really want to be pros after college, they just get lost a little bit in going to a school that's a great fit for them rather than a school that has a huge name. So let's shift gears, or actually, no, let's talk about, you played in college with some really high-level players. You know, guys have had long professional careers. You mentioned Jared Jeffries earlier. So what was it like you know, playing alongside guys like Bracy Wright and Jared Jeffries, what was it like? Did you know these guys were, you know, destined for great careers down the road the second they stepped on campus, or what was it like playing with those guys?
I think, you know, and I'll talk on Jared, you know, he came in as a freshman and you knew he was going to be good from day one. And the thing that was better about Jared than that made our team the best it could be is whenever you have a superstar that's working just as hard, if not harder than everyone else in conditioning and everything else that we're doing, it can't help but make everyone else better. And I think that's what separated him. And you knew he was going to be special from day one just by the way he attacked everything and, you know, how hard he played in every aspect. And then defensively, you have a lot of superstars or high-level guys in college that won't play both ends of the floor and won't work harder than everyone else. And that's why they end up either not making it or the team doesn't do as well as they're supposed to, you know. But the teams that you see in the Final Four all have – you know, obviously NBA level guys, but also guys you would consider great teammates because of how hard they work. And, you know, Jared was obviously the best player on our team, but he worked just as hard as everyone else. And that's what set him apart and why he had such a long and successful career.
Right. That sounds like, that also sounds like, you know, that sounds like two things for me. A great culture you guys had, and also just, you know, recruiting, targeting the right guys, not only high level, but also high character, great work ethic, all sorts of things like that. I think that's what goes into building a great program, you know, talent mixed with high character and those sorts of things. And that's a special player, you know, to like you said, to be working his ass off in conditioning and doing all the right things, playing defense with all the natural God-given talent that he had to score the ball and just go, you know, go get 20 and 10 probably without even breaking a sweat.
And I think that's what a lot of schools will get into. A lot of, you know, really, really talented players, if he's a bad guy and only cares about himself, you're never going to go anywhere anyway. And I think a lot of the top schools, that's part of their recruiting. Yeah, they want, you know, for instance, if you see a top 10 guy ranked nationally in high school, and you see not every top school is recruiting him, there's a reason why.
There's a red flag, no doubt.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't see Duke or Kentucky recruit every single top 10 guy.
Right.
Otherwise, they would just go straight off of talent, and that's just not the way it works.
Exactly. Couldn't agree more. So, in your college experience, you know, you were, at least from my perspective, and, you know, I'm didn't see you play live as much as I could have or whatever, but because I was younger. But what did leadership mean to you? And were you considered like a leader on your team? What does leadership mean within the context of a team to you?
I think it's two things. You know, there's two different types of leaders. There's one that lead by example and how hard they work, and another that's, you know, can be really vocal. But I think in order to do that, you have to be respected. And you know, I put in a lot of hard work, and I'd say we had two or three guys that were really, really good leaders on our team. And I was one of them, just from a standpoint of, you know, not taking any plays off. You know, whenever you have starters that, you know, like I said, and Jared playing just as hard as everyone else, that's kind of leading by example. And then another thing is just knowing everything about your system. And as a point guard, that's something I had to do. You know, I think we had close to 80 sets when I was in college, which kind of sounds ridiculous now, but we went through them constantly, and I had to know those inside and out. So if a player in at every position, so if a player was out of position, I'd always have to stop, you know, and tell them exactly where to go, kind of. And I think that's kind of what a point guard should be, just a kind of an extension of the coach on the floor. And that's another way of being leadership, you know, being a leader. And then the last thing I think a great leader does is just, you know, every team has an adversity, you know, point in the game or the season. You know, if the other team's on a 10-0 run or whatever, it's just stepping up and getting a steal or getting a play that kind of can turn momentum back in your team's favor when they're hitting that adversity point.
Right. Leadership, yeah, I you pretty much summed up, you know, my thoughts on that. But something in leadership, like, you know, like you said, there's the guy who's going to be vocal and, real rah-rah type guy. But I think that guy's the effectiveness of his message loses its power if he doesn't back it up with all the example things. Who are
Yeah,
you to
there's certain guys that can be rah-rah, but if they don't play hard themselves or the team doesn't respect them, it goes on deaf ears.
precisely.
And so you have to earn being able to be a vocal leader.
Right. Like who are you to yell or call someone out, for not being a help side if you're not consistently getting to help side,
Yeah,
or if you're not hitting the
exactly.
floor when there's a loose ball, or if you're not doing all the dirty work and all the things, then you really your voice, if I'm a player on your team, your voice will mean nothing to me, because it's like
Exactly.
your actions speak louder than words. But it's funny, you threw the thing out about, saying you guys had 80 sets and it sounds crazy. I played for an old school coach, you know what I mean? My coach has coached at Oakland for 32 years, I think now. So we had that same, 60 play playbook. And after the practice, if the freshman didn't know the playbook, there's, stacks of it, stacks of the playbook. They got to learn it. They got to learn every position. And that might be a little old school, but that's just how I played, and I like playing that way, because, well, actually,
Oh, no question.
a
And
lot
it
of the play.
gives you such a, you know, you, another, it gave us such an advantage because we felt like everyone on our team had great basketball IQ, and it gave us another advantage. When you can run that many sets, the other team's coach can only scout so much that they can be ready for. And when you have different options and different plays that you can run, and you're only running them once or twice a game because you have so many, it definitely gave us an advantage.
Totally, totally. And then with that, when you have a team with a bunch of versatile guys, like you said, as a leader, you got to get everyone in the spots. And there's a difference between knowing the play in practice when you're walking through and you got the assistant coach as your point guard, just messing around, and there is when you're in the heat of the battle. There's a difference. And are you going to be able to execute when the game's on the line and all those sorts of things? I think they're all tied into leadership, and they're huge. So let's branch off from the leadership thing. Let's talk about when you were in coaching, how much, like, how did you rely on your playing experience to try to maybe put yourself in the player's shoes? Like, how did your playing experience correlate to you in coaching?
Oh, I think it did 100%. Just because, whenever you're coaching, you always kind of related back to, what you had learned and how you had got, whether it's how you got through different screens or, how to, take advantage of getting a guy on your hip when you're driving to the basket and stuff like that. And it's just when you play at a level like Indiana, you can't help but learn different ways you have to do stuff to be successful. And then, that was probably the best part of coaching, or the most fun for me was, just taking experiences you had had as a player that helped you get advantages in the game or against the guy you were going against, and kind of teaching that to the kids.
Right. And then, something that I've tried to think about, 'cause as I've always progressed through my career, whether I was a 15-year-old high school sophomore or my last year at Oakland, I've always tried to sometime, like maybe after the game or after a practice, take myself out of the player's shoes and put myself in the coach's shoes and kind of think about that. And I think sometimes, maybe coaches might get frustrated as, oh, why can't he get this done, or why can't this happen? But then you got to remember the kid's 20 years old, you know what I mean? And he might have had a bad sandwich on the way to practice, or his girlfriend might have broken up with him. And I think sometimes coaches just kind of miss that because there's just some coaches are just so hard on players and, cussing them out and screaming at them and yelling at them. But sometimes it's just, you know what? The kid's 19, 20 years old, and do you know what I'm saying by that?
Yeah, I definitely do, but I do think this, and I've told a lot of teams this as a coach, that like the difference between a really good team and a great team is not having a day off of practice. And the analogy I would use is if, and that all just comes back to habits. If a kid had a bad day at school or whatever, and he came to practice, and everybody's had these days where they're thinking to themselves, God, I just want to get through today's practice. I'm tired. And I just want to go through the motions and get through it. Well, that's say 3 hours, you're taken off when you could have, if you put in the hard work, it, every little bit makes the team better.
Right.
Okay. Well, say you get in the habit of doing that 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. So you got 6 hours a week that you didn't put in and making the team better. And you take that over a year, it could add up to over 120 hours.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
And that's something we learned at a young age. So, and that just comes down to your teammates. Like, you can see a guy not really into it that day is just picking him up and saying, hey, you're still going to work hard today. We're going to get better today. And, you know, that's why, you know, I think that's what separates teams from getting better throughout the season and some kind of staying at the level they're at, you know. And I think it's hard for kids to understand that because they're like, well, what do you mean? It's just one practice. Well, it's not, because you're creating habits and a mindset inside yourself that it's okay to take a practice off, and then it turns into more than just 3 hours.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't necessarily mean the effort thing, but I know what you mean by that, because that's also tied into culture and leadership, because if you have a great culture and great leadership, kids won't be allowed to take a practice off. But more so what I meant was maybe, you know, why can't he grasp a certain concept, or like, why can't he figure out how to do it in real time? Or why can't he knock down the open shots? You know, sometimes it just doesn't happen, you know? He's a kid. There's a learning curve, whatever. He's used to being 30 points a game every night in high school, and now he's got to coach up his ass every day. And it's just, you know, it's just a whole different ballgame. But definitely, I think what you talked about with the whole not allowing guys to take practice off, that comes down to, I think, recruiting high character guys, and then the culture you establish with your assistants.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that too revolves around, you know, really teams have kind of couple players leadership wise that the coach doesn't have to do everything and doesn't have to be that voice every time. It's players that hold other players accountable, and we definitely had that. So you know, I think like we've talked about so much today with the culture, you know, I think that's a big deal when the coach doesn't have to teach and coach every single thing, you know. So, you know, it all comes back down to being a good leader too.
My coach, Greg Campy at Oakland, used to always say a player coach team beats a coach team every single time.
And, oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah, that resonated with me. Just, are you able to, you know, take accountability for your team's actions, and rather than having the coach have to regulate everything? 100%. I buy into that totally. So that wraps up the majority of, you know, the meat and potatoes of what I wanted to talk about. But I have a little tradition type thing that I end every podcast with: the top three. You know, I took only threes my senior year. I'm a 3-point shooter. Let's keep it with the theme of three. And this one is the one I just used this one on my last podcast with George Niang, and I wanted to do that because he played at Iowa State. You know, such a unique experience playing in the Big 12. But I want to ask you this as well. In your college experience, we're gonna do, you'll share one, and I'll share one, and go back and forth for our top three favorite arenas to play in while playing college basketball. Let me hear what's your number one you got for me.
My number one has to be Indiana, which I know is an obvious answer.
I figured,
but
absolutely.
There was nothing like when it was a really big game playing like a top five team, you know, how loud that place can get. And kind of the way it's set up, it feels like the whole place is kind of on top of you. And then, you know, it was just an amazing feeling when you, you know, being a 3-point shooter, when you would hit a big three in a game like that with, you know, over 17,000 people, it's something you really don't forget.
Right.
An incredible experience to be able to experience that playing there.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've never been there, never caught a game, but definitely it'll happen in the future at some point. It's a basketball must, I'd say. You know, basketball bucket list type thing for sure. But I can only imagine, you know, bearing a big three and just that rush of the crowd.
It's unbelievable.
Well, I've done my list before, but I'll share it with you as well. My first one that I'll do is at Oakland University. Our rival was University of Detroit, and it's more of a more of a regional rivalry. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, Duke, Carolina or whatever, but for us it means a lot. And anytime, whether we played at home or on the road, anytime we played was automatically sold out every time, and the schools are only 20 minutes apart or 20 miles apart, so it was just not necessarily about the arena, just the atmosphere. And at Oakland, you know, the arena only holds about 4,000, but it felt like a whole lot more than 4,000.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes when it's that enclosed, mm-hmm. it can be even louder.
Totally. And so those games, whether it was at home at the arena or down at Callahan Hall at Detroit, those games were automatically crazy games. Who you got for the second one for me?
When we were, one year we played North Carolina in the Big Ten ACC Challenge. And even though, I mean, that was kind of a down year for them. Mm-hmm. I don't think they made the tournament, but just it was still sold out, and you could tell the tradition and atmosphere, and going in there and being able to play there was pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. I never got to play in the Dean Dome, but definitely had to have been, like you said, regardless of how talented their team was, had to be a special one. I'm going to share, I'll do a little different than the last list I did last time. This one we played, it wasn't pretty on our part, just the experience was a hell of an experience, but it wasn't pretty because they took care of us. But this was a 2014-15 season when Arizona was ranked number 2 in the country. And we went into McHale, you know, my junior year, our Oakland team we were just average, and they took care of business. But they took care of business. They started the game off 22-2, and they never really looked back. But just the atmosphere, it was, you know, they had the fan support, they were into it, and they were an extremely talented team, multiple NBA guys, and our coach ended up getting ejected, but. I don't know why I'm highlighting such a negative experience.
Well, it's more about the arena and the experience. I think if you're playing in a place like that, and that kind of goes back to Indiana, you can tell it's just got a different feel from what the crowd is.
Totally.
How excited they are. So, yeah. And my third, I mean, I don't know if you – do you want arenas kind of like home floors? Because if not
– whatever you want. Whatever you got for me.
You know, playing at the Georgia Dome at the Final Four, obviously, anytime you get in an NCAA tournament environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of equate it if you play if you played in the NCAA tournament the first two rounds, you know, each level when you get to Sweet 16 and up, it kind of takes it times 10. But then when you get to the Final Four, it's even up by like 100 mm-hmm. from like a home game, and just, you know, seeing that many people in one place was something I'll always forget. And then if you had to go to one other atmosphere that I thought was really cool is, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but before Indiana and Kentucky decided not to play each other anymore, which don't get me started on that.
could have a whole podcast on that,
probably. Yeah, no question. We would always either play in Indianapolis or at Freedom Hall where Louisville was. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, half of the arena red and the other half blue. And that was an amazing experience. And I got to play at Freedom Hall against Kentucky and Louisville. And I thought that place was an unbelievable arena to play in.
Yeah, that must have been pretty crazy to play there. My last one to wrap it up. Well, playing at St. John's, you know, our home court was Madison Square Garden. And, you know, obviously historic arena, but I'll point to the biggest game we played that season that I was at St. John's was St. John's Syracuse, which unfortunately, you know, are no longer in the same conference, but they've continued to schedule that game, and it was down to the wire, and just pretty much one of those classic college basketball games, you know, back and forth. Unfortunately, I wasn't as involved in the rotation as I felt like I deserved to be, or, you know, just didn't get to experience it, you know, on the court. But just being in that atmosphere, sold out Madison Square Garden, half red, half orange.
That's crazy. When there's a game like that where it's kind of 50-50 crowd, I always thought that was an experience. And I think it gave you the most kind of the closest you can get to like an NCAA tournament crowd.
Exactly.
If that makes sense.
Totally.
So, but yeah. And how did they decide if your game was at Madison Square or the other gym that you guys used?
Oh, well, the other gym, St. John's has a gym on campus, but that's only like 5,000-6,000. So I think pretty much they just say the big games we play at Madison Square Garden and the lesser.
That's what I thought.
Pretty much. Yeah. I don't know if that was ever formally established, but that's how I interpreted it. But yeah, it was a hell of an environment at Madison Square Garden. But that about wraps it up. And Tom, really, really appreciate you taking the time. You know, it's a whole new perspective, you know, that you had to offer compared to some of the other guests. So really appreciate it. And I'll look forward to talking to you soon in the future.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure, and I wish you the best.
Appreciate it. Let's talk soon. Take care.